Welcome to Holden Village. This morning in the Creekside Room, we have Steve O'Neill speaking about community organizing, shaking up the status quo. So let's listen in on Steve.
Our group here is somewhat representative of that number. And, you mentioned, Richard, the kind of a definition of community organizing. Very briefly, I think what I look at organizing as in kind of a combination of someone who's been a paid community organizer by trade for many years, and then I teach community organizing some at University of Minnesota and St. Scholastica in Duluth, where I'm currently from. The simple kind of definition of organizing is bringing people together to gain power to make change. So, and really, that's pretty complete in that, I mean, you can get a lot more wordy and you can add some big words. And, but, bringing people together, to gain power to make change. And that's really all the components, I think, that we need to start with. We're ready to start taping if we're not already. And I wanted to start with a little Bible story that might, you may have heard this before, but I like to draw in the good book when possible. And this is a story about kind of the first community organizer, at least in Judeo-Christian history. And you're all familiar with him. He tried to start as a union organizer and very unsuccessful. Moses. When Moses had grown up, he went out to visit his people, the Hebrews. I'm reading from the Good News Bible. I can try to change it to make it gender inclusive, but it's hard in this Bible. And I don't know, Margo, you're on staff here. How should I best do this?
Well, I guess acknowledging that it's the best way. So you can't change it.
He saw that they were forced to do hard labor. He even saw an Egyptian kill a Hebrew, one of Moses' own people. Moses looked all around, and when he saw that no one was watching, he killed the Egyptian, and he hid his body in the sand. The next day he went back, and he saw two Hebrew men fighting. He said to the one who was in the wrong, "Why are you beating up this fellow Hebrew?" And the man answered, "Who made you our ruler and judge? Are you going to kill me just as you killed that Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid, and he said to himself, "People have found out what I've done. I better get out of here." I'm adding. So Moses comes onto this work scene, right? And here's his folks that he relates to. And he decides he's going to take some very decisive action, right? So he kills the oppressor. But he does so in a way without incorporating the support of his people, right? I mean, he feels they're his people, but apparently they didn't feel that he was one of them. So when he comes back the next day, they don't treat him as, a fellow person, as a kindred soul, as an organizer. But really, they're scared of him, and they don't want any part of him. Well, as he didn't give up there. He went back and got married and did various things, and decided that he was going to take a different tack. I have heard the cry of my people, and I see how the Egyptians are oppressing them. Now I am sending you to the king so that you can lead my people out of his country, said God. But Moses said, "I'm nobody. How can I go to the king and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" God says, "I'll be with you. And when you bring the people out of Egypt, you will worship me on the mountain." Well, like many of us, when called to leadership positions in the community, we're not so sure about our skills. And we're not always that confident, right? We have God, we certainly have God's, we have the gospel, I think, that clearly gives us some direction. We're supposed to be working to bring love amongst one another and to bring justice. Well, a little later, Moses answers the Lord, "Suppose the Israelites do not believe me and will not listen to me. What shall I say to them? What shall I do?" And then God gives Moses some ideas. But Moses is still, he can't come to grips that he's going to be, you know, this organizer, this leader. Moses says, "No, Lord, don't send me. I've never been a good speaker." he's really digging. And I haven't become one since you began to speak to me. I'm a poor speaker. I'm slow and hesitant. And the Lord said to him, "Who gives people their mouth? Who makes them deaf or dumb? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? It is I, the Lord. Now go, and I will help you to speak. I will tell you what to say." But Moses said, Moses still doesn't believe God. And of course, he's got this direct pipeline here, you know, which most of us don't have most of the time. Moses says, "No, Lord, please send someone else." We're just talking about Moses, the first community organizer. And at this time, the Lord became angry with Moses. And, you know, you can't blame him. Can't blame God. "What about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. In fact, he is coming to meet you and will be glad to see you. You can speak to him and tell him what to say. I will help both of you to speak, and I will tell you both what to do. He will be your spokesperson and speak to the people for you. Then you will be like God, telling them what to say. Take this walking stick with you. It will help you to perform miracles." So God does a little organizing himself. Decides, okay, Moses just is not going to get into this public speaking role. So I'll find another person, which is what organizing is about, of course, is getting others involved. So he finds this good public speaker. And as you know, the story goes on, and Moses and Aaron, do a variety of things. And as oftentimes what happens when we start organizing, initially when we kind of confront the status quo, when we try to make change, things appear to actually get worse, as happens in chapter 5 in Exodus. The same day, this is after Moses and Aaron are out kind of shaking things up a little bit. The same day, the king commanded the Egyptian slave drivers and the Israelite foremen, "Stop giving people straw for making bricks. Make them go and find it for themselves, but still require them to make the same number of bricks as before, not one brick less. They don't have enough work to do, and that is why they keep asking me to let them go and offer sacrifices to their God. Make these men and women work harder and keep them busy so that they won't have time to listen to a pack of lies." Typical response from the oppressor. Make things worse for people. If they're going to meetings and they're talking about how to change things, don't give them time to do that. Wear them out. Keep them busy, right? It was effective for a while. But as you know, with the help of God, Moses and the Israelites were able to help organize a number of things that made it very difficult for the Egyptians to keep them under the reign. And I just wanted to read one other verse, and this is from Deuteronomy. This is mentioned in Exodus, but it's much more clear in Deuteronomy chapter 1. Moses said to the people, "While we were still at Mount Sinai, I told you, the responsibility for leading you is too much for me. I can't do it alone. The Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in the sky. May the Lord, the God of your ancestors, make you increase 1,000 times more and make you prosperous, as God promised. But how can I alone bear the heavy responsibility for settling your disputes? Choose some wise, understanding, and experienced people from each tribe, and I will put them in charge of you. And you agreed that this was a good thing to do. So I took the wise and experienced leaders you chose from your tribes, and I placed them in charge of you. Some were responsible for 1,000 people, some for 100, some for 50, some for 10. I also appointed other officials throughout the tribes." So here we see, you know, very definitively how Moses, you know, with God's direction, did some really master organizing within this community. I mean, just imagine whatever it was, 1.5 million, 2 million people lifting up their roots, packing up in a short notice with little or no food or water, and, you know, taking off for this long journey to who knows where. And Moses, and then all of these people, you know, kind of keeping things together. It makes Holden look like. and hopefully it should make our neighborhoods, our churches, you know, and so on, look like something that can be organized, can be changed. So it gives you a little sense of, you know, Moses is the organizer. Are any of you familiar with that perspective of Moses? Well, to start with, probably the most important concept to understand about organizing and how things change and how things don't change is the whole notion of power. And organizers really look at power as the key to creating change. Now, I'll just kind of lay it out the way we see it, but power basically is the ability to act. You can say the ability to make change as well, but to make change you have to act, right? So if you want to change a law, you want to change something in your neighborhood, you want to change something in your community, you or a group of people have to be able to act, right? They have to get a city council to write a law and to make a change, or get the state legislature, whatever it is. You know, you want to prevent crime in your neighborhood, you've got to be able to act, to do some actions to help that, to stop that from happening, okay? And while this sounds very simple, we know that gaining power is not always that simple. One, you know, is indicated in our story here, most of us culturally are a little fearful of gaining power. You know, power in our society and culture, as well as many cultures, is looked at in kind of a negative, frightening way. You know, we don't want to gain power. We don't want to be powerful. And in some ways, it could be that societies kind of try to perpetuate that myth, so the people who are in power will stay in power. And in some ways, you know, there's some truth in it. You know, it can be a little scary to be more powerful. Okay. Ideally, what we're talking about is the kind of power that we gain with others, that we gain in community. So that those fears hopefully should subside some. We're not talking about, you know, making me, you, the big cheese, you know, the head honcho, the Moses, necessarily. But in all of us gaining some power with our neighbors, with our friends, with the people we go to church with, whatever kind of community you're organizing. And I will say that this kind of organizing model that I'm talking about really applies anywhere. You could do it when you're out camping with a group of 10 people, if you want. So, to gain power, one thing inherent in that, and some people don't agree with this, but in my experience it's been true, we have to take power. Power just doesn't come. It's not like there's an unlimited amount of power in the universe and we can go out and gain some without taking it from someone. So most of us are not that happy about giving up power. And most of the people who are in power don't want to give it up. How do we get power? What are the ways in our society primarily that we get power? Any thoughts?
Information.
Money. And what else?
Numbers.
Right. Numbers of people. Now, you know, there's other ways, information, you know, there's resources and so on. But if you boil them all down, it could come to money and numbers of people. Okay. So, the Rockefellers had power, because they got a lot of money, right? There's a few of them, but there's not that many of them. The NAACP, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, you know, name any group that has a lot of numbers, they have some power, right? It's not just how many people you have, because you have to be able to organize those people effectively. You have to be able to move to action effectively, you know, and there's strategies and tactics for doing that. But basically, we can look at power coming from these two things. The only other point I'll make on that is in some cultures and societies where you have kings and queens, for example, we usually have money too, but they also, you know, kind of born into power, you know, by this divine right of sorts, or seemingly divine right of sorts. But fortunately, we don't have too much of that here. A little bit. But anyway, so we gain power from money and people. So we organize money or we organize people. For most of us, we don't have that much money, right? And we actually don't know enough people with a lot of money to be able to organize much money. So for most of us, we are talking about organizing numbers of people, groups of people, right? I can have to do a different workshop for people who want to organize money. But I have to say, I don't have that much experience with it. Now, one example of power that seems to kind of crystallize this for people is if you were to look at a child. All of you have either been parents or children sometime in your life. If you're kind of to look at your birth or the birth of your child, and let's say this is their 18th birthday, and this is, oh, you know, 65 or so. Well, when we're born into this world, this is a child, we come into this world with really not too much power, right? We don't have any money. And we're not able to rally up too many people around us. And frankly, if you look at power as an ability to act, we can't even do much, right? You know, we can scream, we can cry and yell, but we can't escape. You know, and if somebody closes a door and refuses to pick us up or listen to us, there's not much we can do. Right? Try crying louder for a while. So, in the beginning, parents have about 99% of the power in that relationship, right? But as that child grows older, they do start to gain some ability to act, right? They can run away. They can hit. You know, they can do things, right? They can start to make things a little bit more difficult for parents, right? They can start to organize their brothers and sisters or their friends. You know, my friend says I can stay on till I schlock. You know, so all of those things that we're all familiar with and that many of us have done in our lives. And as that, those things start to happen, as we get older, we start to gain power in this relationship with our parents, right? And our parents, who, you know, at first had most all the power, they start to lose it. Now, and ideally, that's great, right? That's a healthy relationship. That's how we all want to be as good parents. We want our children to have that ability to act. We want them to gain power. And we want to give up some of that power. Although, at times, that's difficult, right? Like, you know, that first time that your child gets their car or gets their driver's license and they want to go out, and how late can they go out, and where can they go to, and, you know, all those kinds of things. And of course, it happens before cars, too. And at that point, there's struggles, right? And sometimes the parent says, no, you're just not going to do it. You know, I'm in charge here. You know, this is it. This is the rule. You know, and kids use a variety of ways to try to work around that or change it. And ultimately, and eventually they will, right? And so when we reach our 18th birthday or our 21st birthday, we start to, in general, gain more of the power in that relationship. Is that most of your experience? And again, in a healthy relationship, ideally, as we get older, somewhere, you know, that thing that when you were 18, you thought your parents knew nothing. By the time you were 25, you were amazed at how much they'd learned in the last 7 years. I think for some of us, we start to realize, gosh, our parents do have some good ideas, and they have been through a lot in their life. And we start to realize that we can still learn from them, and that maybe occasionally making decisions with them, or, you know, related to the family or whatever, might still be useful. But again, you know, our parents are giving up their power as they go. And at some point, as the child gets older and the parent gets older, the child starts to take over more power in that relationship, you know, like taking care of that parent when they're elderly. And the parent gives that up, and sometimes that's kind of a reluctant refusal, or you know, there's a reluctance to give up that power from the parent. I remember when my grandmother moved in with us for a few years, and you know, there was a struggle there between my mother and my grandmother, and ultimately, you know, my mother prevailed, and you know, my grandmother lost her various faculties, and my mother had to take care of her. So we, you know, we saw in our family kind of a complete reversal of this. So that's a kind of an easy example of how power works in a relationship. And as I said, and I think as you can see, it's not necessarily a harmful or a bad switch. You know, that it can be healthy and it can be good. And in fact, in this case, this is hopefully the way it should work for most folks, right? So in society, if we look at it in our neighborhood or in whatever group that we're involved with, we try to identify those people who are in power, who are making the decisions, and then we try to identify the group of people who are affected by those decisions. And in organizing, we try to gain power, and then, bless you, to be able to go up and negotiate, deal, confront, strike a chord with those people who are in power. Okay, so that's basically what we do in community organization. There's a quote, and I probably should have made a copy of this, but that just... So, you know, this kind of thinking has been around for a while, for many, many years, of course, probably thousands of years. But Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, wrote this in the 1850s, so almost 150 years ago. It was very true then, and it's very true now. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are people who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. That struggle might be a moral one, it might be a physical one, it might be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. People might not get all they work for in this world, but they certainly work for all they get. I'll pass that around so you can take a look at it. It's in a number of his writings, you know, if you ever want it. Of course, you're free to jot it down. But it's a great quote, you know, and it's 150 years old. And, you know, he wrote it primarily around the whole issue of slavery. But it really applies to every issue that we confront. A few years ago, a friend of mine was here, Holden, and he was fishing here on the bridge over Railroad Creek. And somebody came down the creek drowning. He was shocked. And he jumped in and he pulled this person out. And the person was very grateful. Thanks a lot. And anyway, he went back up in the creek, back up on the bridge, started fishing again. And another person came down. And he jumped off, pulled this woman out, and, you know, was kind of surprised. Gosh, you're the second person I pulled out of the creek. I'm surprised. But...
Excuse me, I go check
some
of
my kids. It's a parable. Right. He went back up on the bridge. Third person came down the creek. And again, pulled the person out. And, you know, he said, you know, you're the third person I pulled out of this creek. I just don't understand it. You know, what's happening, you know? And... this person said, well, I don't know if those other two told you, but there's a bully up the stream pushing people in. And at that point, this fellow had to make a decision. Was he going to stay on that bridge and keep pulling people out of the creek, or was he going to walk up, hopefully with a few of these people who had just fallen in or been thrown in, and confront this bully? and try to change that from happening. Now, this is one of the dilemmas that we have in organizing, that a lot of us are trained or start off life wanting to help others, right? I know I was certainly raised that way. And usually that meant helping individuals get through whatever crisis or problem they're in, helping them from drowning. And I went to school in social work for a few years, and that's exactly what we were taught. You know, we're going to help people, you know, deal with the system. Rarely was there a mention of we're going to change the system so people will be able to deal better with it. We'll not be thrown into the creek, into the abyss. So that's kind of one of the dilemmas of organizing, is that we do have to confront the institutional, the causes, the roots of why there are problems for individual people. And that issues, what we call issues in organizing, are things that affect a number of people. They're not individual problems, but they're individual problems that a lot of people have, that they share in common, and that can be solved in common. But there is a dilemma there, because when that person was walking up the stream to stop the bully, there were other people floating down that stream who were being thrown in. So sometimes you're confronted with that dilemma, that you can't take the time, you can't take the energy to go and save that individual because you're organizing a group of people to stop that cause, that root problem from happening. And that can be tough and painful. And, you know, just hard to do. You know, it's I'm sure part of our human nature, you know, as well as just in some ways an easier thing to do, because boom, you know, you save the person right then and there, right? Organizing, you know, generally is not that quick, that easy, or that kind of defined. You know. The two people that I would kind of call to mind in organizing that kind of go back historically in the United States are Jane Addams and Saul Alinsky. Jane was a kind of a social worker, do-gooder, who grew up in rural Illinois, and well-educated, family with some money, and both way ahead of her times as a woman, you know, was an activist for women's rights, for the vote, and had this perspective initially that she could change things in a particular neighborhood. She started a settlement house in the inner city of Chicago called Hull House. And Hull House is kind of on the near west side of Chicago. If any of you have been to, I know Mary has been, Greek Town in Chicago, or where the University of Illinois Chicago campus is, you probably been there tomorrow. That's kind of the old neighborhood where Hull House was. It's near Maxwell Street, which is kind of the old street trading area of Chicago. Anyway, it's an old, interesting neighborhood. And it was one of those neighborhoods in Chicago at the turn of the century when Jane was there that was one of those melting pot neighborhoods, you know, where there were immigrants from all over the world who, when they came to Chicago, this was the place that they would go to because it was very poor. And, you know, you could just squeeze more and more people into these tenement buildings and so on. And, you know, it was a pretty miserable place to live. A lot of sweatshops, garment industry was very active there. And at any rate, Jane built this house, or bought this house, and started this settlement house. She had gotten this idea from folks in England, including Charles Booth, who had started the Salvation Army about 50 years prior. And but she had a little different perspective. She wasn't as evangelical-minded. She was a Christian person, but not as, you know, my mission is to convert people, but my mission is to try to make life's conditions better for people, because that's what I should be doing. And she did a variety of things towards that. Classes, English as a first language. You know, all sorts of different things. And you know, help people with dilemmas and food and housing and so on. But primarily, initially as an advocate, as a one-on-one person, how can I help your housing dilemma? How can I help you find a job? You know, that kind of thing. Well, along in there, they had a program for kids, kind of a Narnia kind of thing, junior minors. And they noticed one summer, and following into the winter, that a lot of children were very sick. And in fact, were dying. And they couldn't quite figure it out, you know, why kind of almost like an epidemic had come into the neighborhood. And they started to look around them and try to figure out, well, what does the kids do, particularly in the winter? And there was no parks to speak of. In schools even were kind of marginal in this neighborhood. And they found that what kids did a lot was they played in the street, in the alley, and in the basements of the building. If it was raining, they would play in the basements. And the streets and the alleys and the basements of this neighborhood were full of garbage. There was really miserable garbage service in the city. Now, you're all familiar with kind of the mythology of Chicago as being the city that works. Just kidding. The city that works if you know someone. Well, people in this neighborhood, they didn't know too many people. They didn't know the people who were supposed to pick up garbage, right? They didn't know their aldermen. And there just was really miserable garbage service in this neighborhood. So people literally would throw their garbage out in the street, throw their garbage out in the alley, throw their garbage in the basement. And it would just kind of sit there and decay and rot, you know, compost. But not in the way it should have. And so kids were playing in this filth, in this garbage, and they were getting ill from it. And you know, in a number of cases, dying. So Jane and her group did some research, which is key to good organizing. They went out and they did some research. They found that in one alley, garbage was now stacked almost 2 feet deep over the pavement. You know, the pavement had been laid some 15, 20 years prior to that. And the garbage had just piled up and piled up and piled up. People didn't realize that their alley was paved, actually. and again, you know, they measured garbage in basements, they measured garbage in streets and so on. And of course, garbage brought rats and so on. And they gathered up this research. They listed the number of children who were sick, the number of children who were dying, the lack of playgrounds, you know, the lack of good schools, the lack of garbage services, how often garbage was picked up, and so on. And they asked for a meeting with their alderman. They got nowhere with him. They asked for a meeting with the mayor. The mayor would not meet with them. They organized a march. They marched down to City Hall, which was not that far. Did kind of an early day sit-in of sorts. I don't think they actually sat. they stood in the mayor's reception room and refused to leave until he would meet with them. Eventually, the mayor did meet with them and said, well, okay, you know, we'll see what we can do. Jane also knew that the media might be interested in this, and she sent out press releases and got the newspapers, early day writers, to go out and do some stories. And by applying that kind of pressure, was able to get garbage service really resumed to their neighborhood. And this is one of those instances where it's kind of that supply and demand. It's a whole sense of power. The people who are in power, they get their garbage picked up every week, right? The neighborhoods that had power, that had either had organized people in numbers or who had money, they got their garbage picked up. This neighborhood had neither, and they did not get this basic city service provided for them. Until they organized, until they brought people together. So that was Jane's first big kind of organizing campaign, and you know, she learned some lessons from it and continued to do that kind of organizing. Saul Alinsky grew up also in Chicago. I think he grew up primarily in Chicago, but most of his adult life was in Chicago. And he started off with the idea. He went to school at the University of Chicago in studying gangs and juvenile delinquency, and which is probably a great place to learn about organizing, because gangs really have mastered organizing, I will say that for him. So he was studying gangs. This would have been back in the 1930s. and did some significant writing on that, and then decided that he was interested in this notion of organizing, so he went out to do some work with John L. Lewis of the United Mine Workers, which was a real up-and-coming militant union of those days, and became close friends with Lewis, who was, you know, a very powerful union leader, up-and-coming, and eventually wrote a biography of Lewis, which is a really interesting book. This would have been back in the 40s. And got this idea that, you know, if gangs can organize and if people in their workplace can organize, why couldn't people in their neighborhoods, where they live, organize and create change to create better neighborhoods and to create more of a real democracy in our country? And Alinsky was a real big believer in that democracy works when people get involved. And, you know, common sense, which most organizing is really, think about it. So he kind of put together this model from his experience with gangs and his experience with the unions and took it to the Back of the Yards neighborhood. Now, some of you are familiar with Back of the Yards from Sinclair Lewis's book, The Jungle, that he wrote some 30 years before. But this was the old packing house neighborhood in Chicago. Very smelly, very miserable. And it was a neighborhood made up of lots of different ethnic groups, and on one side of it was an African-American neighborhood. And I would guess most of the people were Slavic, Irish, Italian, Polish in that neighborhood in those days. And so Alinsky tried to figure out a way of organizing this diverse group of people together. And he had an inside track with the unions, but a lot of people in those days viewed unions as communists, leftists, you know, way out people. This would have been the late 40s. So he tried not to make this too much of a union organization in the neighborhood, but, you know, really more of an overall neighborhood organization. And hired some local people, trained them as organizers, and went on to organize a very strong and effective neighborhood association, Back of the Yards, which is still going today. Unfortunately, and if you read, there's a number of good books written by Alinsky and about Alinsky. There's an excellent biography by Horowitz that's relatively new. Really good book, and really interesting reading as well. Alinsky wrote two books, Revelry for Radicals and Rules for Radicals. Unfortunately, the library here has neither. In fact, there's nothing about Alinsky, or almost nothing about community organizing here, so I'll get after these librarians. Maybe we all can do that. But his lesson there was that he organized people together, and they confronted the powers that be about different issues in the neighborhood. And they did great work on it. And they really made some substantial changes in how they lived, the quality of their life in that neighborhood. Things got much better. But during that time, they found it, one, that they were not able to keep a vision of what we might call social justice up in front of them, number one. So they threw out a lot of the lefty union folks. And two, they were not able, the neighborhood, which was primarily white, was not able to bring in the African-American folks that were really part of their neighborhood. I mean, it was kind of a dividing line of sorts, but they were all in the same neighborhood. And in fact, that group went on to be really one of the most racist, pro-segregation areas in the city of Chicago, really until the last 10 years, maybe.
And they're sort of struggling back to, I mean, they're really dealing with it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, and unfortunately, in some ways, Alinsky gave this neighborhood a tool to keep black people out, you know, because they were well organized. They sold their own houses. The neighborhood association sold their own houses. They would never sell to a black person. Mm-hmm. You know, they made sure they knew who was going to buy the next house. So, at any rate, Alinsky, you know, learned from that experience and went on to organize the Woodlawn Organization, which is primarily, well, almost entirely African-American neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, and the Austin neighborhood, the west side neighborhood of Chicago. And there, he was able to bring people together, bring races together, and try to keep more of a vision of social justice in front of him. But he always struggled with that, you know, because that whole dilemma of wanting to empower people, but then when people choose something that you don't feel is really right or a socially just cause or direction, what do? You know, and that's a dilemma for organizers. So at any rate, he went on, and he started a school called the Industrial Areas Foundation in Chicago. About 20 years ago, that school, he died in 1972 or 3. He then, or they then, the people that inherited the school, moved it to New York a few years later, and it's up and going very well. Two of his disciples that you may be familiar with, the most notable is Cesar Chavez. Chavez was found by a Linsky-trained organizer, Fred Small, who was a wonderful organizer in California for many years. Fred's son is now the director of Neighbor to Neighbor, kind of a peace and justice group that does a lot of work in Central America and other issues. Fred, in door knocking, in building a neighborhood association, found Cesar Chavez in a barrio in Los Angeles. Cesar got involved in this neighborhood association, became a leader. They realized that this guy was really good. They hired him and trained him as an organizer. And then, after he felt he had kind of done what he wanted to do, he decided to take that model and turn it into the United Farm Workers. The other person who is currently involved is Ernie Cortez. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with him. He's from Texas. But he's done a lot of work in Texas and throughout primarily the southwestern part of the United States, really from Texas over to California, organizing neighborhood groups and associations. Our current Secretary of HUD, Henry Cisneros, who was then the mayor of Houston, was one of the opponents, one of the opposition of the group that Ernie organized, COPS. And in time, Cisneros and Ernie became good friends, and you know, Cisneros kind of turned around, and Cisneros gives Ernie and COPS a credit for, in part, for being where he is today as Secretary of HUD. So those are a couple folks that kind of come out of that school of thought of Alinsky's. And I think a lot of kind of trained, paid community organizers view Alinsky as, you know, kind of the direction where they've started. But it really has grown much more diverse now. And a lot of people think that Alinsky was just wrong, you know, that his ideas weren't right and so on. But I think we have to acknowledge that a lot of his conceptual thinking, and particularly that he wrote it down, he put it to work, and he did it when very few other people were doing it, made some sense. One other interesting thing about Alinsky is he realized that the easiest way to organize in neighborhoods was to organize people who were already organized. And who in your neighborhood is already organized? Who's already got a group of people that are members to something, who are churches, right? So what Alinsky would do, instead of going, you know, necessarily door to door to everybody's house, is he would go in and meet with the pastor or meet with the president of the church council. And back then it was mostly pastors. Pastors kind of ruled the churches, and he would kind of lay out his ideas about organizing and about change and about making this a better place to live and bringing people together and developing leadership and so on, and sell this to these churches, and some of them liked it and bought it, and then he would say, "And you're going to have to pay me to do this." And some of them agreed, and in time he was a master at this. Part of it was, you know, he felt, and he was Jewish, not actively, not someone who went to synagogue, I don't know if ever, but he was able to kind of put Christians on the spot, saying, "You a Christian? You want to make change? You want to do good in your neighborhood? What are you doing about these evils in your neighborhood? Are you doing anything? besides preaching. And he was able to kind of use that, and I know with Catholics he was very effective in using our guilt to get people. He got hundreds of thousands of dollars from Catholic institutions. So very, very effective. And any of you have any experience with or know of Saul?
No.
Yeah, I think most people now would not. I think that would be the case, that most people would not have known him. And one of the good things about that is that his job was not to become this big shot, necessarily, but to train and organize people to control, to run, to build their own neighborhoods, right? So it wasn't Saul Alinsky, you know, superstar, come into Austin or Woodland or Back of the Yards or Rochester, New York, or all the different places that he went to. He was there to find leadership, to train them, to develop them, so they could make a change, make those changes in their neighborhood. He wasn't on a platform to become a United States Senator, or the next president, or anything. So, and that's to his credit. And that's why most of us don't ever hear about community organizers. Good organizers should not be in the newspaper too often. So, anyway, that gives you kind of a little bit of a historic perspective. The three models of organizing that are commonly used, commonly talked about, and this is both kind of in more academic circles as well as, you know, amongst organizers, are community development, social planning and policy, direct action, or empowerment organizing. The one that I mostly have been talking about is this last one. But these two really kind of come out of the whole general notion of community organizing. Community development, I just put a few criteria here. Number of people involved. You can do community development with a small amount or a large amount. An example of community development is you're in a neighborhood and it has no grocery store. All the grocery stores have moved out. Or it doesn't have a park, a decent park. Or it has a park, but there's no park equipment. Okay? Let's go with the park example. In community development, you organize a group of people and you say, the park has no equipment, our kids have nothing to play on, and City Hall has ignored us, so we are going to build equipment, we're going to do some fundraising, and we're going to buy swings, and we're going to figure out what people want, we're going to do a survey, and we're going to go out, and 3 months from now, we're going to raise the money, we're going to raise the equipment, and we're going to build a park. Okay? And they do it. You can do it with a little amount of people, you can do it with a lot of people. It's generally not that confrontive. You're generally not confronting the status quo, the power structure. But you are creating change, absolutely. It produces and creates institutions or resources by itself. Okay? Social planning and policy. Generally, small amount of people. Although I've seen it, you know, used where there's a lot of people. Social planning and policy, some of you are familiar with where a group of people will come together in a neighborhood, usually a small group of people, or in a church, or in any group of people, and say, what kind of plan of action do we want for this group, for this community, for the next year, for the next 5 years, for the next 10 years? And they'll put together a group. Again, it's generally not that confrontive. In the end run, it usually creates laws, rules, a plan, a policy, a model. Okay, it generally does not necessarily implement those, but it puts those together. It helps create those. It helps vision those. Okay, this mode is very popular right now.
Yeah, it is. It's the biggest co-op that's out there in communities.
You want to expand on that, Mary?
Well, we get a lot of federal money to do social policy and planning in the community.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of build coalitions, but you know, I mean, who for what?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sort of to bring together. It to me, it's really just a way to sort of funnel a little bit of money in the community to do some stuff and to say, well, you have, you know, you're building coalitions around issues to fight issues. Well, I don't think it works.
Right.
I mean, we're fighting for smaller and smaller amount of money, and sort of coming, sort of it's sanctioned by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And it's thinking money rather than action money.
Absolutely.
So you don't get the changes.
Right.
Right.
And start acting, and you won't get it anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. Don't bite the hand that feeds you.
Right.
So, yeah.
They've gotten smart. We've gotten dumb. They've gotten smart.
They have gotten smart. Absolutely. Right. They have gotten smart. And this can work, okay? People have used this very effectively. But Mary, I think, is right on here. You know, unfortunately, you know, the powers that be have realized that this is a good way to co-opt people. You know, that they can dole out little pieces of money, you know, for neighborhoods to go through this elaborate policy and planning process, and it takes all sorts of time, and it's very exhaustive for generally a small group of people. And at the end of this time, you have this plan, but, you know, anyway, it can be effective. We don't have enough time today to talk about how it can be. But next week, I'll be getting back. So, Nick, it's something that's very popular right now. It's out there. Lastly is this direct action empowerment organizing model. And this is the kind of thing that I talked about with Jane Addams and with Saul Alinsky. Generally, a large number of people, okay? In fact, generally, the bigger the better. Because it's more democratic, because it involves more people. And if more people are involved in making decisions for a community, more people are going to live with those decisions, right? More people are going to believe in them. More people are going to implement them. It can more generally be confronted, because you are more confronting the status quo. You're more shaking up things. You're unhappy with things, and you're pointing it out directly, okay? It produces and creates laws and models, too. And commitments to institutions and resources. So generally speaking, if you do this, you don't go out and build that park. You go to City Hall and you say, we want park equipment in our neighborhood, and you're going to hear from us, you're going to get letters, you're going to get petitions, you know, whatever it's going to be, whatever kind of tactics or whatever kind of strategy that people are going to take, they are going to put some pressure on the powers that be, on the status quo, to make that park happen, okay, to get the money, to buy that equipment, put it in. Now, you know, some of them might be involved in, you know, the implementation, but by and large, the goal here is to make it happen by getting the people who are supposed to be doing it happen, okay? And that's generally the way it works. Any thoughts? Questions? We got about 5 minutes left. I wanted to just tell you two kind of brief stories, I guess. And then I'm going to be doing another session on organizing next week, at least one, and maybe two. So if you're interested, I don't know if any of you will be here next week, but none of you will be here, Greg. you know, I can go into more depth on actually how to do organizing. But this gives you an idea, and you know, there are resources out there. One of the things that has really had a real revival in the last 10 years is IAF, the Industrial Areas Foundation, Alinsky's old school, and a couple other places, most notably the Gamaliel Foundation out of Chicago. There's a couple places on the West Coast out of San Francisco, the Organizing Institute. And these folks have really gone to work very hard in organizing church groups. In Minneapolis, in St. Paul, for example, there's a group in St. Paul called Speak, and there's a group in Minneapolis called JMP, Joint Ministries Project. In my town, Duluth, there's a group called Bond, which is an organization primarily of churches of different denominations, and occasionally they include some existing neighborhood groups or a union here or there, you know, or some little constituency groups, you know, groups of women or groups of homeless people or groups of poor people. But mostly they are groups of church people that have bonded together to try to identify issues in their neighborhood. So JMP, for example, in South Minneapolis. South Minneapolis is a pretty big, diverse neighborhood. There are some real poor areas in South Minneapolis. There's some very middle class. There's some upper middle class. But people have realized that Minneapolis, like a lot of central cities, is becoming poorer. And the tax base is evaporating. And a lot of white flight is happening, right? A lot of white folks are moving out in the suburbs. A lot of people with money are moving out in the suburbs, right? And so city services become more hard-pressed, and you know, and so on and so forth. So this group JMP has done a number of things to try to address it, bringing people of different colors, churches, backgrounds together, different economic backgrounds. One of the things they realized that happens in central cities is that financial institutions decide in a variety of ways that they're not going to make money as easily available in central cities as they are elsewhere. Back in the 70s, this was a phenomenon labeled redlining, where banks and savings and loans would literally draw red lines around neighborhoods. In Chicago, it was any neighborhood that was in any danger of being integrated. So if there was a neighborhood, and they largely did not make neighborhood loans in black neighborhoods either, but if a neighborhood looked like it might become integrated, or looked like it might become a neighborhood that was white, that will be now black, they weren't going to make loans in that neighborhood. It wasn't just banks and lending institutions, it was also insurance companies. And this was well documented, and a number of federal laws were passed, and city laws throughout the country, and so on. Well, that phenomenon still happens, but in much more subtle ways. And what JMP decided to do was figure out ways that they could bring new financial resources into their neighborhood, particularly around housing. And they had the phenomenon of crack houses, you know, abandoned houses, eyesores, you know, vacant lots that were grown up with weeds and so on. And they wanted to try to solve that, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, for crime, for aesthetics, to try to keep people in the neighborhood, to try to bring people into the neighborhood, to try to make it a better place to live. And they basically did two things. They looked at the organizing component, and they went and they confronted some banks and said, we want you to make commitments to our neighborhood. We want loans in this neighborhood for home repair. We want loans in this neighborhood for new home buyers. We want loans in this neighborhood for people of color who want to live here. And they started a little housing agency, kind of a spin-off, though, okay? And they said to those banks, we want you to fund this thing, okay? This is going to be a thing, an organization that's going to train renters to own and buy their own house and to take care of it. So what they did was they started this little organization, and this has been done in a number of cities, and they run people through a program that teaches them how to buy a house, save money, take care of that house, and then they graduate from the program and they buy a house. If you graduate from the program, there's a couple banks, savings and loans and banks now, that will almost guarantee this person a loan. Now, you know, they have to have some good credit, but not the regular good credit that a lot of banks call for. The bank and the organization will help them find a down payment, if that's a problem, which generally it is for low-income people. And it's an opportunity for people to get in their house. One of the beliefs of this organization is that homeowners make good neighbors, that they are invested in their neighborhood, that they want to stay there, that they're going to help take care of it, you know, and so on and so forth. So that's an example of a group of churches that have decided they're going to do something in their neighborhood around kind of a variety of issues, okay, a multi-issue perspective, and it's worked pretty well. I don't know if any of you have seen any of those organizations out there. But, yeah, there's plenty of them in Chicago, right? Gamaliel, of course, is in Chicago, and then National People's Action, you know, is another group in Chicago, where I did most of my training, and the Midwest Academy in Chicago.
Does Jody Kretzman have something to do with that?
Jody
Kretzman?
He has an interesting different model, which is, he was up here in June sort of talking about his model, but he is sort of out of a lot of these. I mean, they're all sort of community organizers kind of hang out. Kind of hang out together. They kind of know each other. But he has a sort of a different model, which is sort of an internal development model as opposed to sort of externally making demands. Externally, it's more of a model of internalized development, which is kind of interesting. He works with, you know, John Knight from Northwestern?
Yeah.
Well, they did a project together.
Yeah.
Yeah,
John's a good guy. Well, that gives you an idea of you know how it works in neighborhoods. Maybe I.